On this episode of ID the Future, David Klinghoffer interviews David Berlinski and Michael Denton as they discuss the debate over evolution. A longtime critic of neo-Darwinism, philosopher David Berlinski is the author of over a dozen books. Michael Denton has been a medical geneticist for more than 20 years. Dr. Berlinski and Dr. Denton are both senior fellows at Discovery Institute. On today's podcast, they discuss why Darwinism has persisted and what weaknesses threaten its existence in the 21st century.
Why does Darwinism hang on? I mean, what is the source of its grip on our minds and on our culture?
I don't know that it's really hanging on. Look, I think we have to be responsible in surveying the history of this debate. Darwin published in 1859, and there was a certain amount of enthusiasm when he published, because it seemed to be a radical solution to a number of problems. But from 1859 straight through to 2011, there's been a steady thesaurus of opposition. So instead of asking why does Darwin hang on, one might ask why is the debate stable, which is a different kind of question. Why has neither one side nor the other, really gained traction in this debate? Mm. And there are complicated answers. I don't think they're scientific. Mm. I think there is, in this country, a tremendous fear that any form of criticism of Darwin has an underlying political agenda. And this goes right back to the 1920s and the Scopes trial. Mm. And H.L. Mencken's very successful description of Darwinian opposition as being the prerogative of men who talked in tongues and handled snakes. Of course, the question Mencken didn't ask, because he wasn't able to ask it, was, you know, they talked in tongues and handled snakes, but they were right. They were right in their objections to this scientific theory. Yeah. And there is no reason that shouldn't be. Right. People can be very primitive in their religious expression and have a very shrewd appreciation, even shrewder than the professionals, about the weakness of a theory. You know, when these people from Georgia, say, or Mississippi, rising from the bowels of the earth to say, I ain't descended from no monkey, Mencken couldn't restrain himself. He said, yeah. You're not descended from a monkey, you are a monkey. But the question we should ask, with a certain amount of humility, I think, because we're all intellectuals, we all are very vulnerable to the same temptation, assuming we're just so smart we couldn't be wrong. The question we should ask is there a shrewd insight in that? This deep, instinctive unwillingness to say the human lineage goes back to simian ancestors. I'm not saying it doesn't. Please understand it. I'm not making a judgment about current doctrine of human ancestry, although I think the story is infinitely more complicated than the Smithsonian and the Museum of Natural History would acknowledge. But I'm saying perhaps there was a very shrewd insight in this stubborn unwillingness to credit a story with insufficient evidence. Hmm. And that pattern, I think, has persisted to the present day. There is a rhetorical stability now. There are three sides. The public, very skeptical by every estimate. The professional academy of Darwinian propagandists who spend all their time blogging about the glories of Darwinian theory and very little time doing anything else. And the critics. Right. And we've reached a three-way point of equilibrium. Very interesting. I don't see much give and take. Yeah. A little bit here, a little traction there. But somehow or other, all parties to the discussion recognize there's something going on that our own interpretation fails entirely to accommodate. Yeah. Nobody's willing to say that, but everyone feels it. We're in the presence of scientific mysteries that make the scientific mysteries of the 17th century when physics was discovered seem almost trivial in comparison. This is a much more difficult problem than any Newton or Einstein ever faced. Much more difficult. Yeah. We cannot answer the first significant question about biology. What is a living system? How would you describe a portion of space and time so that it counts as a living system? We have no idea how to do that. What is a species? All we have is this laughable idea that a species is defined by its lack of reproductive success. Once you can no longer mate, a species forms, a cohort divides. but that's strictly an operational definition of species as some sort of platonic entity. And sexual satisfaction or not sexual satisfaction is an operational criterion. It has nothing to do with the essential identity of a species, which is located we don't know where. But plainly, there is such a thing as a species. And if there is not, we're faced with completely different kinds of considerations. That is, we're not in the presence of the Darwinian question, the origin of species, but we're in the presence of a continuous panorama of living systems that are fluidly exchanging parts with one another and are developing as one single organismic form on the face of the earth. That's a very different kind of consideration. Mm. If the second is true, Darwin is completely irrelevant. It's like asking why the appendix grows at a different rate than the nose. It's all part of the same thing. But my point is not that that's true or that's false, but we just don't know. Mm. We have no good way of describing a species.
I think that the general public have grasped something of what David's saying. I mean, I think they've got this idea that living things are something really strange and wonderful, right? And
the scientific, that's because they read us.
And I think they intuit correctly that, in fact, there is no real answer to these questions, right? Darwinism is just a sort of it's window dressing. It doesn't really answer any questions, and the general public sort of have that intuition that that's the case, right? And the other thing is that I think the mainstream biology, what you've got is in the States, I mean, you can name the people, there's just a key number of people who are defending Darwinism strenuously in proceedings of the National Academy, in various papers. I mean,
sure.
There's people like Miller or, you know, these people. But I'm not sure that they really represent actually mainstream biology. This is a strange thing. I've been working in genetics for the last 20 years. Darwinism was never discussed at conferences or anything. I mean, nobody ever never even comes into the discussion, you know? And I think that, in fact, there's a sort of high priesthood watching for anti-Darwinists and watching for any sort of distortion of these ideas, and they try to stamp on it, you see.
People, that you're talking about a band of sort of Darwinist enforcers who, who intimidate the mainstream scientists in a bullying kind of a way.
Well, they have done in the past. I just wonder what's going to happen over this next decade, though.
Yeah.
But, you see, what's happening is from a sociological point of view, even more interesting. There is a lot of obstreperous bullying, you're quite right. And people are very reluctant to express their views in public, lest the other side be encouraged. But amongst themselves, when biologists talk amongst themselves, the story is completely different. And that is not really making it to the media. That discrepancy between what biologists will say as part of their propaganda effort. I mean, they tithe. It's like tithing in the church. 20% of what they say has to be mendacious in order to support the church. But when they talk amongst themselves, or when you read what they say carefully, then a whole different world emerges. You know, Kunin is a very good biologist, a Russian immigrant. He's just published a big book.
Yeah, what is this new book?
I haven't read it, but I've read his papers.
Yeah.
And he's just as frank as could possibly be. Yeah. It's the head slapping the forehead. We don't know how life emerged, how it diversified. Everything's a mystery. We've got to go to the multi-world hypothesis of quantum cosmology, about which he knows nothing. It's a frank admission that applying Darwinian principles to problems of this level of complexity is like putting a band-aid on a wound caused by an atomic weapon.
Right.
It's just not going to work.
Right.
And there are lots of others.
I think one of the things that's going to happen in the next 20 years, though, particularly in cell biology, is that people are going to have to acknowledge that the reductionist mechanistic approach to the cell is going to fail. I mean, for instance, cell biologists, one of the great doyens of cell biology in America was a guy called Paul Weiss. And if you look at the history of cell biologists have always been skeptical that cells are going to be reduced to molecular interactions. Mm. They've always been skeptical. Weiss is a great hero of mine, Paul Weiss, actually. I've read everything he's ever written, right? And he was very much of a top-down guy. He never believed that he'd ever explain the cell in terms of molecular biology and genes and things, right? Now, this is not directly connected with Darwinism in people's minds, but it is, of course, it is sort of part of the same logical framework, the mechanistic sort of, you know, reductionist framework. I think the signs that, in fact, the cell is where it's at. That's where biology is now focused. Now, that's the frontier, that's the watershed, the nature of the cell. because higher stuff is just still so complicated that it's, you know, it's difficult. But in the case of the cell, you can no longer get away from the idea that you should be able to explain cell form from genes and from below. But you can't do it, even in the case of a red cell. You've got to examine the bulk properties and the emergent properties of cells and things, which are very, very surprising. And as I said to you just earlier about the fact that the red cell membrane studied as a membrane is 200 times more elastic than latex and stronger than steel. And these are bulk properties, emergent bulk properties of a cell, which you need now to explain the form of the cell, right? And this is bringing in the laws of form, it's bringing in physics to explain organic form. And that doesn't work, because once you start bringing in another set of causal factors, see, I mean, anybody can see that if you have to have emergence, like, you know, the water, you know, hydrogen and oxygen, you get emergent features and this sort of thing. Everybody can see this can't be explained by Darwinism, because Darwinism can't go gradually to an emergent phenomenon like the properties of water compared to oxygen and hydrogen. Right. And that's what I'm seeing at the cell. And that's going to create a huge bloody problem. This, I mean, I really can see it coming. And I mean, talking to friends and colleagues, everybody's now admitting that cell form is like properties of water compared to hydrogen and oxygen. You have the proteinomes, you have the interactomes, you have everything there, but you can't see the higher form, right? So this is going to present a huge challenge to the sort of conventional standard model of biology that's been accepted for the last century.
There's a, there's that's a correlative claim, correlative to what Mike just has said. You know, since 1971, the idea of bricolage has been very current. Bricolage is putting things together, taking things from mâché, cobbling things together. And François Jacob wrote a book about biology, and he said biology is the study of things that have been cobbled together adventitiously. Something here, something there, it works, it doesn't work very well, but we get by. The human appendix is there, it's just hanging around, longing for its lost days. The human spine is a masterpiece of maladaptation, but evolution hasn't thought to change it, because after all, we can shuffle along on our spine until we reach sexual maturity, and after that, we go to narcotics, everything is okay. And that idea has been tremendously powerful. The word bricolage has now entered the biological English language.
Yeah.
And from what I can gather, it's completely false. Completely false. And this, I just see emerging step by step. Every living creature is perfect as it is. It cannot be made better. Oddly enough, it comes from the most disparate of sources. Chomsky talks about the perfection of the human language organ. It is absolutely perfect, given that its requirement is to mediate between the conceptual structure of the human brain and the phonological structure of the larynx and the organs of speech. You cannot improve on the language organ. Nature has chosen perfection in order that we should be able to express our thoughts as I am now expressing mine. That is a considerable difference from bricolage.
Yeah.
Physicists studying the eye, the human eye, far from being a kludge, far from being an example of bricolage, the human eye's threshold of detectability is on the order of a single photon.
Yeah.
Now that should send a shiver up your back.
Mm.
Here we are, the product of a messy, intemperate, adventitious, inaccurate, unguided evolutionary process, and sitting on top of our heads are two organs that are perfect. Now, where'd that come from?
Mm.
Every evolutionary biologist with a propaganda microphone close to his vibrating throat will tell you, bricolage, bricolage, think of the appendix. Oh, my aching back. Oh, go on, Berlinski, don't tell me anything is perfect. And yet, he is staring at the microphone with two eyes that are marvels.
Yeah.
Not only of engineering complexity, but of perfection against the measure of design. How much more perfect could they be? No more perfect. And this goes right through the animal kingdom. Every living thing seems to embody its own form of perfection.
This has been ID the Future. Stay tuned for more with David Berlinski and Michael Denton. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2015. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.